listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Tonight's show is sponsored by the Cotton Tree Lodge in Punta Gorda, Belize. More information at cottontreelodge.com. Cotton Tree, River Adventure, Jungle Retreat. Hello and welcome to Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Erica Wides, your host. It's been a while. If you're a fan of this show, if you've been listening, you may have noticed that the last 3 or 4 weeks we've been playing some of our top 10 favorite shows, and that's because I was traveling abroad. But I'm happy to say that I am back, and the show will be live again for the foreseeable future. So you can listen to the show live every Tuesday at 6:30 on heritageradionetwork.com. And I'm very happy to be back in the seat doing the show. I left in mid-January to go back to Vietnam for a couple weeks to continue working on a project that I'm working on there with an organization called Streets International. And I've talked about it before on the show several times. But Streets is a nonprofit organization that is designed to help the population of street kids and homeless kids and orphans that is huge in Southeast Asia, particularly in Vietnam, and to train these kids to work in the restaurant and hospitality industry and teach them English and give them life skills and basically just give them a chance in life to have a career. So if you want more info on that, you can go to streetsinternational.org and check that out. And my role with Streets is that I am the culinary director of culinary education. So I've designed and written the curriculum for the program, and I've been helping to implement it and train their instructor in how to teach it. So I was there for a month last summer, and I went this time for a couple weeks, and it was really great to be back because our first group of trainees have now been there for about 6 months. And so they've had 6 months of intensive English and hospitality training and life skills and cooking skills classes. And they've really, really come far. It's really rewarding and gratifying to see because they're doing so well and they're so excited about their futures. And the next group of trainees starts in a month. So it's really exciting. So you should definitely check out the website. And if you can, maybe help us out. A little bit, a little donation would be great. Anyway, after my visit to Vietnam, on my way home, I stopped off in Seoul, South Korea, for a couple of days to visit an old student of mine who I'm also friends with. And her name's Eunice G, and she's a chef and blogger in Seoul. She has a blog called Pink and Sour. You can check that out, although it's in Korean, but there's some really good food pictures on it. And she's a pretty hardcore serious food person also. So I wanted to visit her, and we had a great time in Seoul eating and drinking and visiting Korean markets and traditional Korean spas and having a good old time. And Korea's climate is pretty similar to New York, so it was really, really cold there, especially after being in Vietnam, which is on the equator and is hot and steamy pretty much all year round. So we did a lot of eating very hot food and drinking and trying to stay warm mostly. I also took a quick trip up to the DMZ, which was very, very weird and creepy and interesting. And if you're ever in Korea, I highly recommend going there, but it's definitely one of the strangest places I've ever been. But anyway, that's not what we're talking about tonight. What I want to talk about is food, of course, because this is Why We Cook. And I love Korean food. I loved it before I went there. I love it even more now that I was there. I don't know that much about cooking it. I know some. In my career, I've always tended toward specializing in Southeast Asia. I know a lot about Vietnamese and Thai and Malaysian, and also a good amount of Japanese cuisine also. And Korean is a lot like Japanese, but it's a little bit more rustic in a way. It's definitely spicier. It's a little bit different. It's not quite as restrictive, I find, as Japanese cooking. Well, when I teach about Asia, when I teach about Asian cuisines in general, and other countries too, there's sort of this loose generalization that you make when you teach about cuisines. And that is that the hotter the country, climate-wise, the hotter the food tends to be in terms of chili and spices, not temperature. And that kind of rings true. It kind of stands up, that generalization. If you look at places like Italy or France, where you start to see chili peppers showing up in the food, but only in the far south, places like Sicily and Provence, or in India. If you look at Indian food, the northern Indian cuisine is heavily spiced, but not spicy, not hot, while the southern regions of India use, you know, chilies like crazy. Even in Southeast Asia, northern Vietnamese food tends to be less hot than southern Vietnamese food. So, you know, you can generally, you know, you can make this generalization about how geography and climate influence cuisine. And you can usually say the hotter the climate, the hotter the food, since chilies and heat in food induce sweating. People in hot climates eat them as natural body air conditioning to cool themselves down. But Korea is this paradoxical cuisine that throws a wrench into that whole convenient theory, because their cuisine is full of chili peppers and spice and heat. And it's pretty far north, Korea. It's way up there. The cuisine is, like most Asian cuisines, based on rice and fish and vegetables and a good amount of beef, too. They eat a lot of meat in Korea. And, of course, like 50,000 or so varieties of kimchi. And that's where the heat comes in. It's not really 50,000. It's probably closer to like 200. Still a lot. There's actually a kimchi museum in Seoul. And I didn't even know it until I went there. But conveniently, it was right across the street from my hotel. I did not plan that. It just happened to be right there in the basement of the Coex shopping mall. So if you're in Seoul, go look for the Coex mall. Coex, C-O-E-X. It's in the basement, the Kimchi Museum. And at the Kimchi Museum, they've documented 187 types of kimchi, official 187 varieties of kimchi. And if you don't know what kimchi is, kimchi is a general name for any vegetable or seafood that's been preserved, either by salting, pickling, brining, a combination of those combined with spices. And the food is generally preserved, and it's also fermented. So it's not just salted to save it. It also ferments. And some are fermented for a long time. Some are eaten a little bit more fresh. But kimchi is sort of like this foundation of Korean food, and it's where that hot chili element really comes in that you don't find in any other northern cuisine that I can think of. And it's the preservation and fermentation process of kimchi that causes the tangy flavor. And that comes from lactic acid, which develops during the fermentation. And that gives kimchi its distinctive kind of acidity and tang and sour flavor. That's such a nice kind of condiment, nice complement to food. But more importantly, that lactic acid creates beneficial bacteria called Lactobacillus kimchii. And those are the important ones. That's the stuff that stimulates your immune system and prevents cancer and keeps people really healthy. It's the same kind of stuff that happens in yogurt and sauerkraut, you know, probiotics. So what I really want to talk about tonight is the miracle of fermentation and the just existence of things like kimchi and its European relatives like sauerkraut, and this kind of weird paradox of Korean food that it's hot and spicy when it's so far north. So we have to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk some more about that. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Why We Cook on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Our show tonight is sponsored by the Cotton Tree Lodge on the Mojo River in Punta Gorda, Belize. Cotton Tree Lodge, River Adventure, Jungle Retreat. More information at CottonTreeLodge.com. So welcome back to Why We Cook. You are listening to this show on the HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I am Erica Wides, your host. This show airs every Tuesday night at 6:30 live, but you can also listen to any show anytime archived on the HeritageRadioNetwork.com website. You can also now listen live 24 hours a day to Heritage Radio, and you can also download any of our shows anytime on iTunes. So you have many options for listening to us. Okay, so anyway, tonight we're talking about Korea. I just came back from Korea, and about Korean food, and particularly kimchi, which is really the foundation, in a way, of Korean cooking. So kimchi, which is this salted, fermented vegetable and or seafood dish that's made in Korea, and there are 187 official varieties of it, according to the Kimchi Museum in Seoul. So kimchi is served with and added to almost everything in Korean cooking. It's used as an ingredient in cooking, but it's also used as a side dish, a banchan. And banchan are those little dishes of all kinds of delicious things that you get served when you eat Korean food. And it's a constant. It's there all the time, every meal. And I love it. I mean, I liked kimchi before I went to Korea, but now I'm like a kimchi crackhead, because I think it's really addictive. I think they're putting something in there. And I can see how easily, if you grow up eating it, you totally get hooked on it. And it's actually one of the first solid foods that babies are given when they start eating real food. They eat like rice porridge, and they give them kimchi because the lactobacillus bacteria in the kimchi is so good for them, and it helps them develop strong intestinal defenses and a strong gut and a strong immune system. So it's really, really good for them. And I always laugh, sort of in, you know, pity, condescension, when I see ads on TV for foods that have probiotics added to them, for these processed foods made by, you know, industrial agribusiness that add probiotics to their food. To me, that's like one of the biggest hypocrisies of the food industry, because if you process a food and you add these probiotics to it, you're going to process the probiotics right out of life. So, you know, you don't need Jamie Lee Curtis selling you Nutra-sweetened flavored yogurt with probiotics added to it. You just need to eat something naturally fermented like kimchi or good quality yogurt. You don't have to buy all that crap. Don't be so gullible, people. I'm sure if you're listening to the show, you're not the kind of person who buys that. Anyway, but foods like kimchi are full of live, active cultures, like yogurt, like miso, like sauerkraut. Anything that's raw and alive like that and is fermented is going to have live, active cultures and bacteria in it. And that's the stuff that's so good. Those are the probiotics, and those stimulate your immune system to be really strong. But kimchi is like this wonder food because it has three times the power of yogurt, apparently. And if you don't like hot, spicy food, not all of it is hot. There are some that are really mild and sort of sweet. They're not all spicy, but a good many of them are. And Koreans love their red pepper and their chili peppers. And in the first segment, I was talking about how that's kind of such a weird paradox, because there are no other northern climate cuisines that use the chili pepper that I can think of. But in Korea, they use red pepper paste to flavor all sorts of food, especially with beef. It goes in the kimchi. This red pepper paste is ubiquitous. When I was flying there, we got served a little tube of it with our meal, like a little tiny toothpaste tube of red pepper paste. And they also use a red pepper powder, ground up seedless red pepper powder, in all sorts of things. But, you know, chili peppers didn't even show up in Asia until the late 1500s. They're not indigenous to Asia. They're indigenous to South America and the New World, and they didn't come into Asia until contact with Europeans was made. You know, you think about like India or Thailand, which have such hot, spicy food, but up until early 1600s, late 1500s, they didn't even have chili peppers there. So it's all a fairly recent addition to those cuisines. But the chilies sort of gradually were adopted into these Asian cuisines and into Korea, but not into northern China or northern Japan, which is really odd. So the fact that they would embrace it is pretty funny in the bigger culinary picture. But it really makes sense to me. You know, often kimchi is made from raw fish or raw shellfish, and if you use these hot, spicy chili peppers, they actually have natural antibiotic properties. So they're going to help if there's any errant bacteria there in the fish. It's going to help to cut down on some of those. But, you know, chilies also warm you up. They induce sweating, and they actually make you feel warm. So some of those really hot, spicy kimchi stews and soups that are eaten in the winter in Korea are, you know, they help to warm you up, and it sort of makes perfect sense. I mean, it's always seemed to me that people in, you know, someplace like northern Finland or Sweden could probably benefit more from eating chilies than, you know, from boiled turnips, which is what they tend to eat in northern Scandinavia. You know, plus it would taste better. Plus, all that red pepper gives you this huge dose of beta carotene, which you could really use in those cold, dark northern places because there's probably, you know, not a tomato in sight for 9 months of the year. So you're getting a lot of beta carotene from those chili peppers. So I don't know why it hasn't been embraced more in the north. But it has in Korea. And along with the hot, spicy chili, you also have the fermentation process in the cabbage. And right there in the northern climate is, you know, that's what it all comes down to when we talk about fermentation and preservation. That's what you need to really do when you have a place with such a short growing season, such a short winter in northern climates. Your growing season is really short, and the further north you go, the shorter the season is. So in pre-refrigeration times, when you couldn't purchase your food and store it and keep it fresh, you had to figure out how to make it last throughout the winter. And, you know, in warm places, too, you had to do that. But in warm places, you could grow food all year round. So that was more of a question of preventing spoilage from heat. But you had food all year round. In the north, you had to make sure you had enough food to survive the winter because you weren't going to be able to grow any again until the spring. So you see it in cold countries all over the northern hemisphere, all these amazing, fascinating techniques that people developed over thousands and thousands of years to extend the life of their food and to prevent starvation. So you see it in things like pickles and sauerkraut and dried fruit and preserves and salted cod and confit and, you know, any technique. Basically what it comes down to is any technique that takes the water out of food will make the food last longer. And all of those techniques just replace the water either with something else or just take it out completely, because water introduces microbes into the food and attracts microbes. I did a show about confit a couple months ago, if you listen to that. And confit is where you take duck and you cook it in fat, and the water in the duck is replaced by the fat, and then the fat preserves it. You know, cheese is another example of doing that. If you have no place cold enough to store fresh milk, which will only last a few days anyway, you have to do something to it to make it last, or you lose that milk. And that's what cheese is. And even yogurt in the more short term is a way of preserving milk. So anyway, back to kimchi and its European cousin, which is sauerkraut. They both start out the same. You start out with cabbage. You can also do this with a myriad of other vegetables, hundreds of different vegetables. But we'll talk about cabbage because that's the most common kimchi. And I want to draw that parallel with Europe with sauerkraut. So you take your cabbage and you salt it. You either soak it in brine or you rub it with salt. And by doing that, you're beginning the earliest step in the process of preservation. by rubbing it with salt, what you're doing is you're starting to draw moisture out of it. And when you draw out moisture, you reduce microbes and it preserves the food. It's less likely to spoil. So you first put the salt on, and the salt begins the process of preservation. But the salt also starts to kill off a lot of bacteria and a lot of the useless or harmful bacteria that we don't want in there. If you left the fresh cabbage just sitting around all winter, it would get moldy and it would spoil because there's bacteria on there that you don't want. But if you salt it, you lower that bacterial count down enough so that only the hardy few survive. And so you put the salt on that cabbage and then you slow down bacterial growth. And what happens is cabbage is full of sugar naturally, and it's also full of yeast. If you've ever bought a head of cabbage and you see that sort of white powdery coating on the outer leaves, that's yeast, my friends. That's naturally occurring yeast. So the salt doesn't kill the hardy bacteria and the hardy lactobacillus. They survive the salt, and then they start eating the sugars that naturally live in the cabbage. And the yeast also kind of perk up, and they start eating the sugars on there. And those bacteria and yeast that are there in the salt bath, they don't have any competition. So they start having this wild party. They start eating all the sugar in the cabbage. And like any other living thing, after they eat, they digest. And like every other living thing, after they digest, what do? They excrete. But what do they excrete? They excrete lactic acid. And lactic acid is what gives foods like sauerkraut and pickles and kimchi sourness. Lactic acid is sour, and it creates that tartness, and it's lactic acid fermentation that we want when we make things like pickles, sauerkraut, kimchi. It's the same thing that happens with sourdough starter. When you make sourdough starter, what you create is lactic acid. It's a byproduct of yeast digestion. So it's excreted by the yeast into the starter, and it makes the sourdough starter sour. It's the miracle of fermentation. We have to take a break. We'll be right back on Why We Cook. Welcome back to Why We Cook on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. If you're a fan of Why We Cook, I would love for you to visit the Why We Cook page on Facebook. Just search on Facebook for Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network and join as a fan and let me know. You can send me any questions, comments, criticism. I'd love to hear any of it. We'd love to see you as a fan of the show. So tonight we're talking about kimchi and its European cousin, sauerkraut, and the miracle of lactic acid fermentation. So now where kimchi and sauerkraut kind of differ, where their paths split off, is that kimchi is made from cabbage that's been salted. But then it's also rubbed down with red pepper paste. So the red pepper paste gets rubbed on the cut surface of the halved heads of Napa cabbage. And the pepper paste also goes in between every leaf. And the pepper paste helps the fermentation along, but it also adds a lot of flavor. And it also adds this really hefty dose of beta carotene and other immune fighters. And, of course, like I said, it adds flavor and it also adds that spicy heat, which is also really good for you. Once the red pepper paste is put on the salted cabbage, the kimchi then gets packed into these big ceramic jars, traditionally these big, tall ceramic jars. And then the jars get put underground or into a sort of root cellar where they're left for a couple weeks to ferment. Now, the same thing happens with sauerkraut, but the cabbage is shredded, tossed with salt, and then kind of kneaded until it gets really juicy because the salt, of course, pulls out all the juice. And you want enough juice, enough brine when you make sauerkraut to let the cabbage stay fully immersed in that liquid, because if it pops up above the liquid, it'll get moldy on the surface. So you usually weigh it down, keep it immersed in the brine. Same thing, pack it in a ceramic crock and then put it someplace cold, usually in a root cellar or, again, buried underground. Now, the burial in the ground is to serve a couple purposes. One, originally it was kind of keep animals away from it, but also it's because in most of the northern hemisphere of the world, in the temperate zone of the world, the underground temperature is always a nice, cool, steady 55 degrees around. Now, obviously not up in the Arctic and not near the equator, but, you know, where most of us live, it's always around 55 degrees, and that's the perfect fermentation temperature. It's cool enough to keep things slow and keep bacteria in check, but it's warm enough to allow fermentation to continue. If it gets too cold, fermentation ceases. And if you're a wine person, or if you know anything about wine, you know that the perfect cellar temperature is also 55 degrees, because that's the underground temperature. So you put your kimchi or your sauerkraut underground, and while it's spending the winter down there, the fermentation process is kind of slowly marching on, and it's making things more and more sour. That lactic acid is making it sour, and the flavors are starting to really develop. Now, with sauerkraut, you usually reach a point at about 6 weeks of maximum sourness, and after that, it's not so palatable. So usually what people would do is after about 6 weeks, they would take the sauerkraut, they would cook it and can it in jars, you know, like processing jars. And that would arrest the fermentation process, and it would also sterilize it. The problem with that is once you cook it and can it, you actually kill off all that live bacteria. So it'll still be good for you, but not as good for you. Kimchi tends to be eaten at around 2 to 3 weeks of fermentation, although you can eat it for much longer than that. And my friend in Korea, Eunice, was telling me that, you know, it'll just continue to ferment. It'll get stronger. The flavor gets even more intense. And people will eat it up to about 7 years old. She said there are restaurants in Korea that specialize in serving aged kimchi. But it gets pretty funky after a while. But it's the same idea. After about 2 or 3 weeks, you take it out and you cook with it. And that obviously stops the process. So, you know, when the snow is falling and the ground is frozen and people in northern countries aren't growing any food, they're eating their fermented cabbage and their other vegetables, and they're surviving the winter and they're staying healthy. And, you know, why? Why is this stuff so good for you? What is it doing? Well, cabbage actually contains huge amounts of vitamin C. I know. Crazy, right? Vitamin C in cabbage. It doesn't seem likely, does it? But, you know, how do you think people survived without vitamin C in the days before oranges were shipped up from Morocco or Spain to Northern Europe? Before long distance refrigeration, before railroads, before any of that, it was very rare to see an orange in a place like Finland. So people, or, you know, Alsace. So people got their vitamin C from cabbage. And, you know, the British sailors knew this for a long time. People knew that if they ate cabbage products in the winter, it would prevent them from getting scurvy, which is a vitamin C deficiency. And so the British Navy used to take fermented cabbage. They would take sauerkraut with them along on really long sea journeys when they'd go out for years at a time to sea. Captain Cook, James Cook, always took sauerkraut on his sea voyages to keep his men from getting scurvy. And eventually the British Navy switched from sauerkraut to limes. They would bring limes along, which is why the British sailors were called limeys, and that's why the Brits are called limeys. But the German sailors continued to bring sauerkraut, and that's why they're called krauts. That's where the name came from. Anyway, so as I was saying before about kimchi, it has these probiotic powers like yogurt, 3 times the probiotics of yogurt. So it's really good for people who can't eat dairy too. And it also has very high levels of vitamin C, like I said, and beta carotene. And after the fermentation period, after about 3 weeks, the B levels, the B1, B2, and B12 actually double after that 3 week fermentation period. And those B vitamins are really important in traditional Asian cuisines like Korean or Japanese, where people didn't eat red meat. At least traditionally, not a lot of red meat was eaten in places like that until it was introduced by Europeans. It's also important for vegetarians, and when you have Buddhist countries, you tend to have a lot of vegetarians, and vegetarians tend to be deficient in B vitamins because you can only get those B vitamins either from meat or from fermented products. So people who are vegetarians tend to eat things like kimchi and miso, which also has a lot. And the Japanese sort of invented this culture of making miso because they didn't really eat a lot of meat. They ate no red meat, actually, until the late 1800s because it didn't exist in Japan. Red meat was introduced into Japan by Europeans because Japan was closed off to the outside world until then. And interestingly enough, too, when the Japanese started eating red meat, that's when they also started eating tuna. Because before that, tuna was not considered an edible fish. It was oily. It was very distasteful. It was dark. They didn't like the flavor of it. It was only something that the really, really poor people ate. But once the Japanese started eating red meat, they developed this taste for tuna and began to enjoy eating it raw. And now they've basically enjoyed their tuna to the brink of extinction, unfortunately. But anyway, those B vitamins that if you're a vegetarian or if you don't eat a lot of meat are really, really important. They come from fermented foods. So from things like miso, from kimchi, from tempeh, from other soy products. But back to the kimchi, back to kimchi and the cabbage, it doesn't only stop at cabbage. And that's sort of what I loved about it so much, is there was so much variety and they were offered up so generously at every meal. And I ate kimchis made from daikon and scallions and raw squid and green beans and bean sprouts. There were, you know, hundreds of them, 187. And every meal is served with them, with banchan, which are those little tiny dishes, if you've eaten Korean food, those little side dishes that come with it. And what I love is that you could ask for refills of any of them, and it was so graciously given to you. Here, you know, something served with your meal, and that's it. If you want more, you have to pay for you got to pay for another order of it. But there's a great communal sense to eating in Korea. There's this kind of really nice, like, family feel to eating there, and definite pride, serious pride taken in all the food that was being made and was being served. So I really loved it. And kimchi making was also always like this very communal affair, and family members would get together and help each other out. And same thing in Alsace and in Eastern Europe when it was sauerkraut time, it was harvest time. There were actually guys who had the shredding machines who would make their way around and help everybody shred their cabbage. You know, so it comes from at a time where there was, you know, the possibility of starvation. So this all comes out of necessity, but it also comes out of this real kind of community sense of making food together and then serving it together and surviving together. And, you know, that's really what we don't have anymore, because we live in a time when we're lucky enough to not have to worry about starvation, but I think we've also lost something because of that. So, you know, maybe next fall here we'll have a little communal kimchi making party at the radio station. Who knows? Anyway, we are out of time. I hope you learned something tonight about fermentation. And remember, you can listen to the show live every Tuesday night at 6:30, or you can listen to us on iTunes. And thanks for joining me tonight on Why We Cook, and we'll see you next week.